Hey, welcome to the Cordial Catholic Podcast, a podcast for non-Catholics, new Catholics, and those who want to explore the Catholic faith. In this episode, we're talking to Dr. Douglas Beaumont, speaker, writer, and editor of Evangelical Exodus, on the hows and whys of evangelicals becoming Catholics. It's a great conversation, even after I edited out the part where my son comes into the studio and asks to use the bathroom in the middle of the interview. Oh, and hey, just for the record, I asked Dr. Beaumont what I should call him during the interview, and he said Doug. Hi, welcome back to the Cordial Catholic Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Douglas Beaumont. Dr. Beaumont received an MA in apologetics from Southern Evangelical Seminary, his PhD in theology from Northwest University, and is an evangelical convert to the Catholic faith. His book, Evangelical Exodus, covers his time teaching and studying at Southern Evangelical Seminary, and his journey along with several of his colleagues and friends who became Catholic. Hi, Doug. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Dr. You. Thanks for having me on.
The first thing I want to talk to you about, I want to ask you about, is I do want to get into why you became Catholic and why evangelical seminarians would become Catholic. But I do want to start with kind of the how of becoming Catholic. And one thing you start off with in your book is the idea of a paradigm shift. So it takes a shift of a paradigm, somebody's worldview, for them to make a conversion like from evangelicalism into Catholicism. So I wondered if you could talk about the idea of a paradigm shift to start with.
Yeah, I'd love to. And just to give credit where credit is due, I pretty much lifted this idea from Christian Smith, sociologist from Notre Dame, who wrote an excellent little book with a rather long title called How to Go from Being a Good Evangelical to a Committed Catholic in 95 Difficult Steps. that's a mouthful, but it's actually a pretty short book, and it's excellent. I would highly recommend it for anybody that is going through this kind of paradigm shift, religious conversion, or is concerned about someone who is, because it's really helpful in kind of applying the principles that Thomas Kuhn used in his famous book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. He was talking about how science proceeds through its different evolutions and beliefs, and then applies those to religious conversion. I think it's really helpful to understand the different stages as such, because I think for a lot of people, we tend to see conversion as just like this event, and it's really a long process. And depending on where people are in the process, different things are happening. So different people have broken the steps down. I typically see it as kind of three or four stages where one really begins in whatever paradigm you're in. So maybe it's the religion you grew up with, or maybe it's one that you converted to first. But you're basically happy. You're going to church, you're just doing your thing, and everything, or at least most things, seem fine. Obviously, it's not perfect. You know, every religion, every faith has some issues, but generally, you're satisfied with it. Where this starts to change is when maybe some of those problems that have been out on the periphery start to become more front and center for you, and you start realizing that, you know, there's some actual kind of serious difficulties with this view that I hold. I know for many evangelicals, myself included, one of those things was just unity. You know, it's pretty clear in Scripture, from Jesus' high priestly prayer in John 17 to, you know, St. Paul in several of his writings, notably 1 Corinthians, that unity of the church is a big deal. It's expected of the church. And yet, not only does evangelicalism certainly not have anything like that unity, but it almost seems to be the cause of the disunity because of its very principles. And you know, you can also talk about, and we can talk about this later, but, you know, things like, you know, where did the Scripture come from? If we can trust the church for that, you know, why can't we trust it for other things? Anyway, as these aberrations start to multiply, You go into a stage called drift, where if you kind of think of maybe a boat securely moored at the dock, you know, it's now out to sea a little bit. You know, maybe the chain is still holding it to the to the deck, but you know, you're kind of in the some choppy waves now. And at this point, the person who's going through this paradigm shift starts to try to maybe make alterations to their view. Maybe they're including ingredients from other views that are typically seen as outside, you know, the normal pale for this particular faith. So maybe an evangelical starts to become really reformed, or maybe they start to become really free grace, or maybe they even go a little, you know, charismatic or something in trying to resolve these aberrations. But if that doesn't work, and depending on what your aberrations, your issues are, a person going through a paradigm shift enters a crisis stage. And this is where they start to see that this just isn't working. I can't alter the original view enough to really account for these problems that I'm seeing. And so the resolution begins to be seen outside of that original paradigm. And so maybe they look out. I know for me, I saw the more liturgical church, spoke to some Anglican priests, and realized, hey, you don't have a lot of the same problems that we do, and there must be a reason for that. And eventually, I became convinced that evangelicalism itself was the issue, that it was raising these problems, not just suffering from them. And at that point, really, the only way to totally resolve the problems is to shift into a different paradigm, just replace the old one, and then you know, you've kind of come around the horn now, and you're back into the initial stasis where the aberrations have been dealt with, but you have come to see that you just cannot remain in the old paradigm. You have to move into a new one, and that's what we call conversion.
Right. You know, that's really interesting. I actually had a conversation, and thank you for that. I do love that framing. And I remember when I first read Evangelical Exodus, and I hit that introduction chapter, and suddenly my own conversion made a lot of sense to me. And I chatted with a reader once of my blog who was going through kind of an exodus out of their evangelical faith, and their journey mirrored a lot of my journey as that paradigm shifted. Now, they ended up becoming kind of an agnostic. It was interesting in the sense that we went through the same kind of journey, that paradigm shift, only their conversion was to one of kind of unbelief, where mine was one that ended up me in the Catholic Church. And we both started in a very similar place, but our paradigms just shifted. That evidence we looked for, that as we drifted, the places we looked for a new paradigm were in different places. It was an interesting, eye-opening experience about how universal that paradigm shift is.
Yeah, I can definitely understand that. I mean, I think especially for, you know, really committed evangelicals, and that's the kind of Christians I was typically around, you know, some of these aberrations are very serious. They're very problematic, and they strike at the root of what the evangelical sees as being Christianity. You know, most notably, I think the ideas of the canon of Scripture and its orthodox interpretation. Those things are often just taken for granted in evangelicalism, or they're treated in such an idealistic and vague way that a lot of the problems really just never seem to exert the kind of pressure that they probably should on someone's mind. And so if the church, if the ancient church isn't seen as a viable option, I mean, what else would you have? I mean, agnosticism or, you know, possibly taking the next step even into atheism would not be terribly surprising. And I know people, you know, even from the seminary where I attended, that focused on apologetics and defending the faith that kind of ended up going that route. Because for them, the shift into the ancient church was just unavailable for whatever reason. They just couldn't deal with it. But without it, those aberrations really can't be answered. They can't be answered on an evangelical account. And so I could see someone drifting off into agnosticism if they refuse to recognize the authority of the church to do what it does.
So why don't you take us a bit through your journey, and then we'll talk a bit about the other journeys recorded in your book.
Sure. I became a Christian right before college. So that was kind of like the end of the first big shift in my life was just becoming a Christian at all. I ministered with mostly evangelicals, Baptists, those types, and quickly became very interested in apologetics. I wanted to be able to defend the faith the way that people had that helped me come to faith. So I ended up moving to North Carolina, studying at Southern Evangelical Seminary under Norman Geisler and some other really great Christian intellects, and just kind of honing my craft, trying to become a really good apologist. And eventually I was hired on there. I ended up teaching there for 10 years. And when I was doing my doctoral studies, I thought, well, now is probably a good time to dig a little deeper into some of the questions that have not really been answered for me yet. And some things that had come up, some of these included, the idea of orthodoxy was something that had bothered me for a long time, because it seemed like we had a very almost blurry line between where we considered somebody to just be an aberrant Christian or whether they were just straight up in a cult, And I had heard numerous explanations. Well, looking at the essentials, but then where are those found? Like who decides who the essentials are? And it just seemed like there was always another step that had to be taken. And so I decided to take those steps. What is the notion of orthodoxy? How do we really know if someone is in the Christian faith or not? And I found myself running up against the ancient church. These creeds and these councils that virtually all Christians, adhere to, a lot of the stuff that is in those is not something that is just sitting there in scripture right on top where an evangelical would expect it. So that was one difficulty I had. And then the other one was that if we're going to hold the sola scriptura, this idea that the Bible alone is our ultimate authority, then we've got to have, some pretty solid reasons to give it that authority. And of course, as anyone who has studied the scriptures knows, that the Bible is not an it. It's not really one thing. It's a collection of things. It's a collection of books. It's a bound library. So where did the library come from? Where did the table of contents come from? Because that's not part of scripture. So there had to be another authority that says it is. And once again, I run into the same that is putting together the creeds and the councils. So, the obvious question eventually arises, why am I not a part of that church? And so that led me into about a 5-year struggle. I was in the crisis mode, to use the paradigm shift language, for half a decade, just fighting through these things and trying to get any answer that wouldn't be Catholic, because I didn't want to be. The last thing I wanted to do as an apologist was have to defend, the Pope and the Crusades and the Inquisition and, indulgences and all, I'm just seeing this dark tunnel ahead of me. How could I ever, be on that side?
Yeah.
But, because I couldn't get away from the foundational aberrations, the things that were, crumbling the evangelical view, I finally faced those things. And then, as I actually started to learn real history and read people that aren't just, anti-Catholic propagandists, and I'm reading real actual historians, not all of them Catholic, it became pretty clear that a lot of the things I had been told were overstated or untrue. I started to really get a lot more of the political motivations and things behind the Reformation. And as all of those things kind of cleared away, it became pretty obvious to me that I didn't have a good reason not to be Catholic anymore.
But there is that interesting idea, right? That as your paradigm shifts to a point, and like you say, as you look into these issues, that the evangelical sphere of things, the evangelical framework paradigm can't explain, you do get to a point where you have to say, well, I don't have enough reasons not to be Catholic anymore.
Yeah, and I think it has to do, at least from my observations, is really with kind of the felt strength of these aberrations, these anomalies, whatever you want to call them. I've got a very good friend who's, I guess, evangelical. He doesn't really seem to know what he is anymore. But we talk about these kind of things all the time, and 99% of the time, he is in 100% agreement with the points I'm making, and he was with me through this whole shift, so he knows, you know, what's going on. And he'll be the first to admit that evangelicalism cannot account for these things. All these arguments are really bad, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then when it comes to, well, then why not become Catholic? It's like, well, because, you know, that's about the best.
Well, and funny you mentioned that. I like the notion of the felt strength, right? Because what you say, I mean, my journey started with a question from an evangelical pastor about scripture versus tradition. And for me, that became the thread that I slowly began to unwind in my evangelical worldview. But for that pastor, well, he kept on being a pastor. He continued on being a pastor because, I guess, like you say, the felt strength of that aberration, that problem for him wasn't strong enough to compel him to go any further. Whereas he set me on a journey that changed my entire worldview and my life.
Right. Yeah. One thing that I tried to stress to people, and, you know, they don't usually believe me, but it really is true, is that, you know, until just the last, you know, waning moments of my crisis time, I wasn't reading Catholics. You know, I was reading everything I could to respond to these things in a non-Catholic way so that I could stay out of the Catholic Church. So it wasn't as though I was just, you know, sitting around reading Rome Sweet Home one day and went, oh my gosh, this is all true, and then boom, you know. In fact, it's funny, just a personal story related to this. Many, many years ago, Jeremiah Cowart, one of the authors of Evangelical Exodus, good friend of mine, he was one of the first that I knew of to become Catholic. And after he did, I decided I better read Rome Sweet Home and see what I thought about it. And my memory of reading Rome Sweet Home was not being terribly impressed. You know, it's like, okay, you know, there you go. There's a book that I read, check, you know, throw it on the shelf and forgot about it. So after I became Catholic, I was digging through my books and I found the actual copy of Rome Sweet Home that I had read. And I thought, you know, I wonder what I would think of this book now. And I opened it up, and incredibly, I had all the good arguments highlighted, all the arguments that I now make. I had written notes in the back, and I mean, I had really paid a lot of attention. I mean, like I my memory is not of paying much attention to this book, and yet it's clear that I did. It's clear that I understood the arguments. I had them all highlighted. I had notes, everything else. Why didn't that book move me? I mean, like, this is, to me, you know, this was it, you know, like all the arguments that I needed to become Catholic are right here in this little book. And yet I barely even remembered it having an impact on me. So, you know, the great thing about Catholic theology is they've had 2,000 years to think about stuff. You know, there's answers for everything. You know, I know that the human will steers the intellect. You know, the way our mind reacts to things, we'd like to think that we're totally objective and that logic, you know, can rule our lives and this sort of thing. But the reality is how we feel and what we want can largely determine our reaction to things. And even if we're looking at a perfectly logically tight, unanswerable argument, it doesn't always move us. And that's, you know, that's why faith is in the will. That's why it's rewardable. At the end of the day, somebody really has to decide to be open, or it's just not going to happen.
That's really fascinating, because I had a similar but different experience, in that a Catholic friend of mine gave me a copy of Rome Sweet Home. It was in my final semester of my undergrad, and I didn't read it. It sat on my shelf, and I gave it back to him at the end of the semester, unread, unopened. And when I met him years later after I became a Catholic, he said to me, well, I gave you that book like 10 years ago. Did you read it? And I had no memory of reading it, and I realized, well, no, I didn't read it. It sat on my shelf because I wasn't even at a place to even read it yet, let alone open it and make those notes like you did.
Yeah, and this is why I think that this idea of the paradigm shift is so helpful, because, you know, somebody who is in stasis, that first stage where they're generally happy and feeling good and solid and everything else, just isn't going to have the same kind of reaction to those kinds of arguments and things as someone who's in the crisis mode, say. And so I think that helps when people, you know, when we do share books and people don't react to them the way we think they should. You know, it's not because they're idiots, and they can't follow logic, and it's not because they just have sinful hearts. You know, we're just in different places, and you know, we've got to recognize the different stages for what they are. And I'm seeing a lot more people, not necessarily speaking this paradigm shift language, but I think of Sherry Waddell and her ministry that is kind of applying these sorts of principles to the church. And it's so helpful to realize that, you know, there are legitimate stages in a person's faith life, and the way they are should be thought of and handled and treated in those different stages can be radically different. And there's just, you know, you can't just have one tool in your toolbox, as they say. It's funny, you know, a book that I read, you know, toward the end of my crisis stage, you know, might seem like the end all be all of Catholic apologetics at that stage. And yet, you know, a couple of years back, it didn't do anything for me.
Right. And for me, when I did read Rome, Sweet Home, I read it three times back to back because I was that moved by it. But, you know, it was 10 years later that I read it.
Sure.
And then I did give, then at the time, my evangelical pastor had asked me for a resource. He said, okay, give me one book that will convince me of your arguments, because he was interested. And I gave him Rome, Sweet Home, and he had the most flat reaction, kind of, well, this is uninteresting and boring, and I'm completely unmoved by this. But it's that, it's that, which for me was heartbreaking. That was the exact opposite reaction that I was hoping for from him. This was a book that I read three times in a row and was just, is fantastic. And it just felt totally flat, but it's that paradigm. Now, do you think that that book, though, you know, plants a seed? Like, would you say it planted a seed for you when you first read it?
I'm sure it did. I mean, you know, one thing is these aberrations have to come from somewhere. And, you know, for someone whose life consists of, you know, family, job, going to church on Sunday, and that church experience is a big part of their social network, and everything is basically fine, you know, it may just never even get to the point where they're even concerned at all about where the Bible came from. I mean, it's like, it just almost has this obviousness about it. You know, this so clearly works, and it's so clearly good in the lives of the people around me and everything, that, you know, somebody else can worry about the canon. You know, I don't know, somebody figured it out.
Yeah.
Easier to kind of blow off, because, you know, there's just, I'm just not, you know, there may be, you know, like what I tell people, what I try to tell Catholics so that they don't get the superiority thing going, you know, is, you know, I've started off talks by giving a bunch of arguments for the flat earth, you know, and everybody laughs. And I go, okay, well, what is your answer, though? You know, answer this argument for flat earth. And most of the time they can't. And I said, well, then why aren't you converting, like, right now? Why aren't you becoming flat earth? You can't answer the argument, can you? You know, and that's the thing. You know, when we're in this nice round earth stasis with everybody around us enjoying it as well, you know, it's hard to take an argument seriously, even if we don't know the answer. The assumption is, well, clearly there's an answer just because I don't know it. And if you go home that day and you're not terribly bothered by the argument because it just seems stupid, or the view that it's arguing for seems ridiculous, you're just going to forget about it. And
right,
you know, and again, that's just what life is like in the stasis stage. And so I think what happens is that, you know, but suppose you went home and then, you know, your spouse brought up some arguments for the flat earth. And then you went to work and your best friend at work brought up some arguments for flat earth. And next thing you know, 5 years has gone by and all these people, you know, are converting to flat earth, and you're hearing the same argument five or six times. Now you can repeat it yourself in your head, and you're thinking about it in the middle of the night. You know, that's how the aberrations start to really grab hold and
right.
Drift stage, because, like, wow, this is something I actually have to deal with and I can't. And now it's bothering me. So I do think that even if someone reads a book and says, eh, whatever, you know, the fact that those same arguments converted me years later, you know, says something about their power.
Right. Now that all my flat earth listeners have tuned out the podcast.
I'm sorry if you lost him.
Okay. So This book you edited, Evangelical Exodus, is the story of these seminarians at a particular seminary and their paths to Rome. So could you maybe in some broad strokes just talk about some of the reasons why some of these people, colleagues of yours, some of these evangelicals became Catholic?
Yeah, one of the reasons that I really wanted to see this book come into existence was that I was around when a lot of these folks became Catholic. Even when I was nowhere near doing so myself. Then there was a number of them that were struggling with a lot of the same things at around the same time I was, and we would have conversations with each other, and then some even came along later. But I was kind of privy to some of the backroom talk at the seminary and realized pretty quickly that the way these guys were being talked about was uniformly unfair and false, and just the whole view of what was going on with the seminary was not being reacted to very well. And I knew the real story with a lot of these guys, and I knew I wasn't hearing it. So I thought, you know, it'd be great if all these stories, you know, could maybe just be in one place. And of the 30 or so people that have become Catholic out of this small evangelical seminary, you know, about 10 of us or so decided to write it up. And what I love about it is just how different the stories were. You know, one person really just fell in love with the Eucharist, and his wife bought into the idea of getting off of birth control. And then all of a sudden they discovered that the Catholic Church had been teaching that, you know, for 2,000 years. Another person became very moved by Our Blessed Mother, Mary, which, you know, that's not usual. <You know? laughs> Usually Mary is kind of the last domino to fall. You know, she's not the initial cause. But, you know, that happened with more than one person. Her story's not in here, but Brian Matthews, who did write his story, I think he talks about it. His wife actually accidentally got a hold of a book on Mary that Brian was specifically told, like, don't read this unless you're thinking about becoming Catholic, because it's pretty heavy. And, you know, definitely don't let your wife see it. She ends up grabbing it out of the box of all these, you know, Catholic books that Brian had been given. She read it and bam, she's ready to go. You know, that switch flicked and she's like, sign me up. And then a lot of us came in through kind of the paradigm shift model that I was talking about earlier, that there were just certain concerns we had, that the deeper we looked, the worse it was looking for the faith we had been taught, or at least in the way we'd been taught it. And some of those, you know, some of them you have to run into if you're converting out of any kind of Protestant group, no matter what. Like, eventually you're going to have to deal with, what about sola scriptura? What about the Bible alone? What about sola fide? What about faith alone? And so in the book, I actually ended up extracting that material from the stories because I didn't want it to be 800 pages long. And so the four appendices really are kind of the meat of the argument section of the book. And then the individual stories are the more personal versions. But, you know, all of us had different starting points. I mean, I watched the seminary that we were at tried to start a church, and I watched it rise up and then melt down. And that was a huge catalyst for me to really rethink how we do things. You know, in my view, it was like, well, you know, as a seminary student, I've been complaining for 5 years about how bad evangelical churches are, you know, and then we start our own and it turns out to be just as bad as all the other ones. You know, if we can't do it, who can? And that kind of opened my eyes that, you know, maybe there's just something wrong with evangelicalism, you know, not necessarily any individual evangelical person, but the framework, the network that is set up that we you know, from a distance refer to as evangelicalism, it just can't sustain certain things. And once you get out of your little pocket that you run around in your life, you start to see that, yeah, you know, a lot of what I believe is not supportable on this system. And I think a lot of us, through various personal experiences, whether they're intellectual, emotional, you know, moral, whatever, it caused all of us to start this drift kind of thing and spend a lot of time trying to fix the problems that were opening our eyes to these other views and eventually coming to think that shifting into these other views was really the only long-term solution.
Would you be able to pinpoint a source of why so many seminarians at this particular seminary became Catholic? Was there one thing that was at least making it more likely or kind of pushing that paradigm?
Yeah, I think I think you can ask James White about that. Yeah, the guys at Westminster and James White from his bedroom podcast will tell you that the problem with Southern Evangelical Seminary is primarily that we actually learn philosophy, and not just any philosophy, but we under the influence of Norm Geisler, who kind of snuck Thomas Aquinas into the evangelical world through his ministry throughout the years. You know, many people will look at that and blame that orientation on why so many people become Catholic. It is certainly a door opener. The fact that you might see an evangelical seminarian walking around with a Bible under one arm and the Summa Theologiae under the other arm is a little odd. there's probably maybe zero other schools that are really like that. SES had a huge emphasis on classical apologetics, classical philosophy, even classical theology up to a point. You know, we read way more Catholics than we read anybody else in certain classes. So what was interesting is, you know, you'd take your philosophy classes, you'd learn all about Aquinas and the Thomists and how bad modern philosophy is. And then you take your theology classes and you'd read Thomas Aquinas and the Thomists and you'd learn how bad modern theology is. But then you'd go to your salvation class, and all of a sudden you're reading, Dallas Seminary guys. And that was kind of an abrupt and odd shift.
Yeah.
To suddenly be reading these guys, you know, these views that didn't exist prior to the late 19th century. And, you know, I mean, in the seminary itself, we used to joke about the fact that, you know, if any one of our professors ever left, all we needed to do was find a dispensational, Thomistic Baptist, and we'll be fine. we had all two of them there already.
There's one on every corner,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So, you know, we had this very, really kind of bizarre and eclectic mix of, you know, late 19th century Americana end times and salvation views. But then it was mixed with all this incredibly solid logic and philosophy and theology of God from the Catholics. So I think that definitely opened a door. It definitely made people a lot more Catholic friendly than they might have been otherwise. But the kind of disconnect that one might expect from such an experience really wasn't there for a lot of people. I mean, you know, a few hundred people have graduated from the seminary and, you know, only about 30 or so have become Catholic. That's still a huge number considering, that's close to 10% probably. If you map that onto a school like Liberty or something that graduates thousands a year. So I do think that was definitely part of it. SES tried very hard to make it very clear that one can accept Thomistic philosophy without accepting Catholicism. And I didn't really see a lot of people having too much trouble with that distinction. So I would challenge James White and others like Oliphant that have kind of blamed this Catholic exodus on allowing classical thinking into the school. But they're not terribly far off. That certainly played a part.
Interesting. Well, it's almost as if, and I see this, I saw this as an evangelical, we read some of the church fathers or some of these doctors of the church, but just pieces of them, right? So you'd read Augustine, but you'd read just pieces of his theology. You wouldn't read where he talks about the Eucharist or where he talks about authority in the church or those kind of things. You would just read pieces of him that agreed with your already existing framework or worldview or paradigm, right, as an evangelical.
Yeah, the problem of proof texting exists, whether you're looking at the Bible and you're just picking out a passage here or there that sounds like what you teach, as it does with the church fathers, for sure. I was honored in my second year, I think, in seminary to become the president, Norman Geisler's assistant, research assistant. And on top of grading, my other job was to help him write his systematic theology. So he was on volume two, I think, when I started working with him. But my primary emphasis was volume four. So what's interesting is that volume two was the nature of God and creation. Volume four was more about the church and end times kind of stuff. So while I was working on volume two, my job was to find quotes from church history that backed up Geisler's view. And it was pretty easy. I mean, it was overwhelmingly easy, really, because he had a classical view of God. However, when it came to volume four, and I had to start finding church quotes that agreed with his salvation and view of the church and view of the last things, as we would call it as Catholics, or the end times, as they would call it, the job became considerably more difficult. I mean, there just wasn't hardly anybody that agreed. And, you know, I didn't know anything about church history at the time. We didn't even offer a church history class at SES. So I was basically just literally doing like a word search. Anytime I would come across a statement that sounded anything like what Geisler taught, I would just copy and paste it into a document and hand it over. I figured, well, you know, this is his systematic. He's the one with the doctorate. If this is an illegitimate quote, you know, it's up to him to figure that out. I can't learn all of church history, you know, this semester, you know. So, you know, what amazed me was that these quotes just ended up in the book. And, you know, of course, looking at it later, I realized, like, none of these guys agreed with him, you know, at least in several instances. And yet there's their quotes, as if Geisler just kind of noticed something that the church didn't notice for 2,000 years. And secretly, this Baptist doctrine had been taught the whole time. And you know, the church just hid it away cleverly in all of the church fathers. So, in fact, I remember when I was talking to Francis Beckwith one time, he jokingly said, you know, did Geisler even read the next page, you know, after this particular quote? And I said, I don't know if he read the original page, because I'm the guy that gave him all these. I don't know what happened there.
Right. That's interesting, because you have these modern systematic theology textbooks, right? And I have wondered myself, well, do these authors think that they've just now figured it out? And the church has got it wrong for the previous, you know, 2,000 years?
Yeah, there really is this kind of modernistic evolutionary assumption that goes along that says, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants, but, you know, we can see farther than them. You know, it's like both of these things together. You know, and I remember Geisler actually saying this one time. He said, well, you know, if you look at the history of theology, you know, the church has been kind of working things out in a systematic manner. And basically now we're in the time where we're kind of nailing down, you know, things like the nature of the church and the end times. So, you know, for them, it just, yeah, the fact that something didn't come along for 1900 years really wasn't a problem. It just, you know, the church just hadn't gotten around to it yet. Of course, that's not true at all. You know, the church had very strong statements to make about many of the things that I was researching. We just didn't happen to agree with it. So, yeah, that kind of mentality and that proof texting methodology, that happens with the church fathers just as much as it does with scripture.
Okay, so here you were, an evangelical in seminary, doing all this studying, this paradigm shift happening. So where did you finally end up, and where are you now? Where does that Catholic convert go with after years of studying in an evangelical seminary?
Yeah, one of the difficulties I think that converts find is that, you know, you might be coming from a place where you're pretty impressive, you know, in the evangelical world. And then, you know, you look at the Catholic Church and it's like, you know, your deacon has a PhD, you know. You know, we're just not terribly impressive to people that have been Catholic their whole lives. So for me, you know, about a year before I kind of saw the writing on the wall, I was still not really wanting to become Catholic, didn't know if I would, but I knew for sure I was not going to make it another year as an evangelical, especially teaching at a seminary. It would just have been dishonest for me to really continue on. It was just getting too difficult. So I had to quit my job, drop out of my doctoral studies that had already been going on for 3 years, and then try to figure out the next thing to do, you know, switch churches and all that good stuff. So that was very difficult. And it was difficult on my family, difficult on finances, you know, everything. So, you know, I kind of went into the secular market for a number of years. And when I actually became Catholic, I just, you know, kind of kept my head down and just tried to see what was coming next. But eventually, you know, my own charisms, you know, they come back out. You know, I really wanted to teach. I really wanted to get back into the swing of things. And so I started looking around for work, and I eventually found the position of director of religious education at a parish in California, which my family and I had been wanting to get back to California ever since we, you know, moved to North Carolina practically. And it worked out perfectly because I had finished my PhD work at another school, and so that was completed. And you know, I had a lot of experience. I had, you know, a number of years teaching. I had a number of years in management. So put the two together, you know, as far as just skill wise, I was good for the role. And you know, now I had another 3 or 4 years of being Catholic and continuing to study theology under my belt. So I was in a really good place to make that transition, and so that's how I ended up where I am. I'm still the director of religious ed here at the parish, and I think it's been helpful. You know, we've done some things with some of the programs with RCIA and some of the confirmation programs that I think are going to help strengthen the faith of the people that are in them, because we're including some apologetics, we're including some specifically evangelical issues that I know they're going to get when they walk out the door, you know, either from friends or family, coworkers, that sort of thing. And I think it's really been a boost to the parish to have those things.
Yeah, it's interesting. As you tell that story, I'm thinking of, and this was true for me too, and maybe it would resonate with you as well. I feel like we forget sometimes that this paradigm shift, this conversion to becoming Catholic, I mean, God is involved, right? You almost think, what am I going to do? Where am I going to land? How is this going to make sense for my family and for my faith life? And will I find a church? And will I find new friends? But does this make sense to you? Do we often sometimes don't involve God in that, to trust that there's a purpose and a plan behind this?
Oh yeah. I mean, it can feel like such a dark place, you know, especially depending on who's with you and who's against you. And yeah, I mean, it's hard walking away from a professional and ministerial and social networks that are now, you know, looking over their shoulder at you, and you know, you're kind of starting to see the real character behind certain people and maybe even yourself. Yeah, it's hard to believe that there's going to be a good outcome sometimes, you know, and I'm not at all comparing myself with Job, but, you know, I do resonate with this idea that, you know, yeah, sometimes you lose a lot, and then, you know, God doesn't give you any guarantee that he's going to fix it. You know, you can go into it with faith that yes, God is with me, but yeah, maybe this is a martyr situation, you know, where I'm just going to lose everything and that's going to be it. You know, I mean, you have to be ready for that. But then again, it might be a Job situation where you lose a bunch and then God gives you even more than you had. So there's a tremendous amount of faith involved in that sense that, you know, this is not a sure thing. You may not get what you want, but, you know, God is going to be with you either way.
When you were on this journey, you said that you saw these seminarians and friends of yours, colleagues of yours, becoming Catholic kind of ahead of you. I think about my own journey, and I've heard a lot of these kind of journeys where, as an evangelical, I had no idea people became Catholic. I didn't know that was even a thing. So was it different for you knowing that evangelicals did become Catholic and that wasn't a completely unheard of, bizarro world thing?
It was surprising the first time that I knew that it had happened with someone close to me. You know, I was fairly familiar with the idea, I guess, just because I'd heard about Scott Hahn and a lot of these guys kind of early on. But it was kind of one of those things that you just never think it's going to happen to you. So especially Jeremiah, you know, when my buddy Jeremiah Coward became Catholic, he had moved to Atlanta. I hadn't seen him for a while. And then all of a sudden, the next time I saw him, you know, his whole bookshelf is Catholic, and he's got, you know, Rome Sweet Home videos, you know, stacked up on his TV. So it was kind of shocking for me in the sense that I didn't think anybody I knew would ever convert. That just seemed way too out there. You know, we're the smart guys. We're the apologists. You know, you're not going to fool us the way you fool these other people. So when it started happening, that part, I would say, was more surprising to me. I understood that people did it in general, but I just never thought it would be something that my people would do.
Yeah, I always found that interesting. I remember Googling books for evangelicals looking at Catholicism, and then I realized, wait, there are actually lists of books on the internet that are suggested reading material written by Catholics for evangelicals, and just that blew my mind. And your book hadn't come out at that point, but I think that would be near the top of the list if it was published at that time. But I had no idea that was a thing. And then here are these lists of actual books that Catholics wrote for evangelicals. So that was very eye-opening for me.
That is funny. Yeah. For whatever reason, I started kind of collecting conversion books early on. I don't know why. I wasn't interested at all in converting myself, but there was just something really fascinating to me about people, you know, being that mindful of their faith and yet still changing. You know, this wasn't just someone who got married and, you know, couldn't do it if they weren't Catholic, or, you know, was born into a certain faith and then came back because they wanted to, you know, their kids to get the sacraments. You know, these were people that had careers, people that had promising futures, that were really, you know, deadly serious about their faith, you know, and reading their stories was just always kind of mind boggling to me. So fairly early on, as I was growing more and more uncomfortable with evangelicalism, I probably got, you know, a dozen of these books, you know, and I read all the big ones, again, sometimes more than once, found Rome Sweet Home again. that was something that I know, I think, you know, pretty much all the authors of Evangelical Exodus would agree that we really were helped a lot by knowing other people's stories. And so, you know, it was a real honor when Ignatius said they wanted to do this, you know, to kind of add our voices to that library of conversion books.
Well, and it's a fantastic book. I remember when this first came out a few years ago now, I just love the diversity, like you say, of stories in here. It kind of gives so many different angles of people converting from things, like you say, issues of contraception to issues of the Eucharist to issues of scripture and authority and the church. When I read it, I found my story in many different stories in this book, many different angles and reasons why I became Catholic were reflected in this book in different people's stories and all these different starting points as well. So I do appreciate this book very much. And I think that any evangelical interested in dipping their toe into the Tiber, as you say, in your story, would be very interested in this book, at least to explore some ideas, right? We talk about this paradigm shift, and there's no, maybe unfortunately or fortunately, there's no one-stop shop, no one book to give somebody to convince them of the arguments or the reasons or the compelling beauty of the Catholic Church. But I think this book, Evangelical Exodus, will certainly give a lot of food for thought.
I appreciate it. I'm glad you like that. We're still trying to pump more stuff out. And my website is douglasbeaumont.com. That's kind of the hub for everything else. So you can get to the book, the book's website from there. And you can, there's the paradigm shift thing we've been talking about is an article on that website, if anybody would like to see that out, you know, more in print.
Well, thanks for joining us on the podcast. Really appreciate it. Appreciate your time. And I hope this has been edifying and interesting for those listening. Thanks so much, Doug.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Cordial Catholic Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. It was a really fun interview for me to do, and hopefully you enjoyed listening to it as well. And hopefully you learned a bunch too. Make sure you like this podcast on Apple Music, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play Music, TuneIn Radio, or wherever else you get it. Any likes and reviews and subscriptions help push the podcast to more people and spread the word. It'd be awesome if you'd like us on Facebook at The Cordial Catholic. Visit me at thecordialcatholic.com. Send me email at cordialcatholic@gmail.com. And I've even dusted off my ancient Twitter account at cordialcatholic. And you can tweet me there if you like. If you're interested in helping support the show, it costs about $12 a month to host this podcast. And if I can find 12 people to give me $1 a month, we'd be set for life. Or as long as this podcast lasts, which hopefully is a while. Check out patreon.com/cordialcatholic to support the show. That'd be fantastic. And hey, any of the quotes and articles and books, like Dr. Beaumont's fantastic book, Evangelical Exodus, are linked to in the show notes of this show at thecordialcatholic.com. It truly is a fantastic book packed with interesting stories of conversions from all different sorts of people and all different angles and different reasons and different kind of motivations. It's a really interesting book if you're interested in that topic. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to the show wherever you get it. And God bless. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcafe. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.